thanks for joining us this morning. Our guests today are Mark Barnes, an enrolled agent and owner of Copper Canyon Tax Service, and IRS Special Agent Brian Watson. And we're going to be talking about taxes.
Exciting stuff.
Yeah. Okay, let's try not to go to sleep. And I want to start with, you have a bullet point here about misconceptions. I want to start with misconceptions.
So there's a ton of misconceptions out there. And oddly enough, just the other day, someone posted a poll in one of our tax groups to kind of see what the misconceptions are across the country and what people normally see. So this is kind of a rundown of some of the things that popped up that we deal with a lot. Number one on the list was an extension of time to file equals an extension of time to pay. And this is a misconception because the money is due to the IRS by April 15th. An extension of time to file just gives you an additional 6 months to get your act together and get your tax return filed. But the money was still due April 15th, whether you have an extension or not.
Oops.
The second one that came up, this is an interesting one. And there's a lot of these multi-level marketing programs out there that are not helping with this. If you have a home-based business, you can write off everything as an expense and get a big refund. If you have a home office, you can write off expenses that are allocated to your home office. So one, you have to actually have a qualifying office. And then we have to look at the size of that. If that home office represents 6% of the square footage of your house, we can write off 6% of the expenses associated with operating your house, not your entire house. Another one on the list. You're a great tax preparer if I get a big refund and you did something wrong if I have to pay. You know what? I can't undo what you did last year. If you made decisions last year that negatively affect you, it's time to deal with reality. And if you go somewhere else and they've got some magic, you know, you should remember the conversation from the last time I was on the radio. You're ultimately responsible for your return. And if it's filed fraudulently, it comes back to you.
Yeah.
The next one's my favorite. It's probably Brian's favorite as well. If I ignore my tax problems or IRS letters, they will go away. Man, the IRS is not going to forget about you. It's just not how it works. Sometimes they get busy. Sometimes there is an extended period of time between communications, but they didn't forget about you. And the longer that goes on, the more interest and penalty you will ultimately pay. This one's a bad one, especially in our community. We have a lot of people that are putting solar on their house. Tax credit for solar panels is refundable. So it's not. It's a non-refundable credit. It reduces your taxes to zero, but you're not going to get a refund of any additional amount. So when you put those $30,000 worth of panels on your house and you've got a $10,000 credit, that doesn't mean the government's going to send you $10,000. If your tax liability was $2,000, it's going to reduce your taxes to zero, and you'll get back any withholding, and the remainder carries forward. We get probably a dozen calls a year on the next one. Inheritances are never taxable. There's also on this list that inheritances are always taxable. So it's an area of confusion. If you're going to be receiving an inheritance, contact somebody. Somebody should be managing the estate. And the taxability of what you receive really depends on the character of the assets and income that are coming to you. If it's non-taxable income at the estate, it's non-taxable to you. An example would be there's $100,000 sitting in a non-interest-bearing checking account, and you're going to receive $25,000 of that. That's a non-taxable event. If it's income from a retirement account or dividends from stocks or rental property income, those are taxable events to the estate, and they're taxable to you. Let's see here. I'm 65 years old, and I no longer have to file. Depends on your income. You may or may not have to file. But you certainly shouldn't make that determination without having all the facts.
Consult somebody.
And then the two that came up yesterday, head of household status. So in order to qualify for head of household status, you need to have a qualifying dependent on your tax return.
Yourself?
Yourself is not a dependent. This would be a child, your child, not just a child, but your child And there's a few other cases where you could qualify for head of household status.
Pets?
No, not your pet. The case that we ran into yesterday and what we see a lot is, hey, last year I bought a house. Now I'm the head of household. Yeah, that's not really how it works. You're the head of your own household, but for IRS purposes, you are not qualifying for the head of household status. And another one that comes up almost daily is child support, claiming children, and court orders. And the message here is court orders are a state-level item, and the Internal Revenue Code is a federal item, and what you see on a court order does not have more authority than the Internal Revenue Code. So when we get into who can claim children, there's a very specific set of rules that need to be followed, and your court order is secondary to me. There's rules that we need to follow so that you're not in contempt of court, but that court order doesn't override the rules of the law of the nation.
Okay, you're talking about ads and stuff like that too. There's an ad on TV, and I wanted to run this by you, Brian. It says that the IRS is going to take your home. They're going to take your car. They're going to take everything if you owe $10,000 or more, whatever it is. And, you know, call me because I can save you. Does the IRS take your home?
Yes, possibly, but that's not the first thing that happens. The important thing to remember is, If the IRS needs to get a hold of you, you're going to get a letter in the mail, okay? And sometimes people get behind. And what everyone is entitled to is to set up a payment plan. Basically, what the worst thing you can do is just ignore the IRS. Because like, as Mark said a few minutes ago, it's not like, oh, this guy's not responding, we'll just ignore him. No, there's a collection process. And so if you've been assessed money, you owe money, they're going to try to collect on that money. So the best thing to do is be reasonable, respond, explain your situation. Look, I've been sick. Look, I got laid off. Look, my business tanked because of a lawsuit or something like that. Engage with them, set up a payment plan. That's the best thing you can do. When you ignore, and then when you start hiding money, start moving money, eventually they have to get a little more aggressive, and that could involve levying a bank account, that could involve taking assets. So I mean, just to give you an example, I've been doing this job for 25 years. Twice I've been out in the field with a revenue officer. Those are the collection people, and we've seized cars. Well, I didn't. The revenue officer seized cars. We went out there as the special agents to provide security. So it doesn't happen very often. And by the time they got to that point, it was years of avoidance and hiding money and things like that. So yes, could that happen?
It will.
But it's way down the road. You know, and I've talked to many friends of mine who've gotten behind in their taxes, and they told me, yeah, Brian, the best thing I did, I just engaged with the IRS employees. They're going to treat you like a human being. It's mutual respect. They'll work with you because it's a lot easier for them. For an IRS employee, a revenue officer, to take a vehicle or to seize a bank account, it's a ton of work and it takes a bunch of time. They would rather work with someone, set up that payment plan, and have it get you out of the hole that you're in.
Okay, I just wanted to be sure because Zag comes out and it's pretty scary. They're
right.
Going to come take your house.
And you realize that the people that have that ad are a profit business. They
right.
are trying to make money. Whether they're going to ask for a retainer from you, they're going to charge you high fees. A lot of these things you could just do on your own.
I was going to say, you just say,
yes,
I'm going to do this on my own and save that money?
You can do an installment agreement, basically set up that payment plan for free. You do not have to hire anybody to do that. That's where you're going to save your money right there.
Okay, good. I'm glad we talked about that because I see these ads and I'm just like, oh my God, this is making you sound like a bad guy, and that's really not how it works, at least not up front. Okay. You can file your taxes for free at the IRS. What do you have to do to qualify for that?
So if you make your income is $69,000 or less, you're eligible for IRS free file. And we've been really pushing IRS free file. We want more and more people to take advantage of it. You just go to irs.gov and it says file your taxes. You click on there and you can just start the process. Now, if you make over $69,000, you're not eligible for IRS free file, but we have something called IRS fillable forms. So you have to do your information somewhere else. But you can do it online. And the big thing is we want everyone to file electronically for a variety of reasons. It's more accurate. You're not going to have errors. You'll know right away if your return has been accepted or rejected. It saves the government money because you're not handling all this paper. And then also your tax return can't get lost in the mail. And then here's the number one kicker. If you file electronically, you're going to get your refund much faster than if you use the old snail mail. So I've been filing electronically for years. Our percentage now, just to tell you what we're dealing with now, we're up to 89% of taxpayers file electronically. It was 87 the year before. Our goal's 100. We're never going to get there because there's always someone who wants to do the old school paper. And
sit in the car on the 15th at the mailbox and drop it off to the people.
We used to do that.
They don't do that anymore, do they?
No, because everyone's filing electronically. Or if people are in a panic, they do the extension like Mark talked about a few minutes ago. Yeah, we used to provide security to IRS employees who were helping out at the post office on April 15th, and we would be out there till midnight. But this was over 20 years ago. No one does that anymore.
Do you miss it?
No, because I'd rather be in bed at midnight, you know?
Just thought I'd ask. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a few. Okay, we're back. And I want to talk a little bit, but there's so much to talk about today. We've got two pages of topics. I want to talk about the required, the deductions and the credits on your tax returns. What would stall your return? What would delay your return?
Well, the couple that would delay it are the earned income tax credit and the additional child tax credit. The reason why is because in the last few years, unfortunately, we've seen an increased level of fraud associated with those two credits. So even though the filing season opened this past Monday on the 27th, and most people can get their refund in about 7 days if you have a straightforward return and you file electronically, those two credits there will actually hold up your return until about mid-February this year.
Okay, what is an earned income credit?
So earned income tax credit has been going on for a long time, and it is something Congress created, put it in the tax law, and it's to encourage people that are lower income to work. So it's an incentive to work, and it's actually a refundable credit. So even if you you can actually get a big check back. Some people get checks for $5,000 or $6,000, and it's basically an incentive. But unfortunately, like personally, I'm a little jaded toward the earned income tax credit, and that's because of my history of working investigations where people put on dependents that aren't theirs. They're basically borrowing dependents from people or stealing identities from people and putting kids on their return to basically get a bigger refund and creating false W-2s, putting them on there. And that's why there's a level of fraud associated with that credit. Now, but in reality, most people that use it are using it honestly. And it is an incentive for people to work as opposed to sitting there going, well, I'm just not going to work. But it's definitely an incentive to work. But it is a refundable credit. And that will hold up your return just a little bit. Your refund, I'm sorry.
So it's not worth getting pregnant for?
Well, kids, you know, are very expensive. And I found it too with my kids is, you know, I always thought babies were expensive because of diapers and formula and child care.
Wait.
My kids have gotten to be teenagers and that involves cars and college. And man, that gets a lot more expensive.
It's crazy. Okay, what is an identity protection PIN program?
Okay, so we had a big problem with tax-related identity theft a few years ago. It's still ongoing. It's basically where someone steals your identity and then files a return without your permission to get a refund.
Money.
Right. And when people were victims, we were giving them, starting in 2011, a PIN number, basically a password for their tax return. And I actually was predicting this, and I was right. Now we've actually piloted a program where you can opt in to get that PIN number. And now we're up to 20 states. And Arizona, yay, happens to be one of those states where you can opt in and make your tax return more secure. And I think what's going to happen, we always pilot things, you know, to try them out. And if it works, in a year or two, we're probably all going to have a PIN number on our tax return.
Well, how do you get it?
You just go on to irs.gov and you can actually, you go on there and request it. There's a whole section It's an opt-in. There's a publication called the 5367, but you basically just go on there and you can just go you go irs.gov/IPPIN or IPPIN, and you'll find it. There's many ways you'll get to it. It takes a little work because you got to prove who you are. It's not made to be easy. You got to fill out some forms. I got to verify some stuff. But if you're one of these people that goes on extension every year and you're worried that someone might get your
tax return in before you,
try this PIN. Check it out. I thought about doing it this year, but I kind of waited too long, and I'm ready to file next week. So I'm going to do it for the next year.
Just okay. Can you pick your PIN, or do they assign it to you?
I don't know, Sherry. It's one answer I don't know. That's why I wanted to do it, so I could tell all your listeners how it works and that it actually does work. But you know, we did the same thing with electronic filing. We didn't just do electronic filing for everyone. We started it in certain states and certain areas. Arizona happened to be one of the pilot areas for electronic filing years ago. And once we see that it works, then we try it out for everybody.
I have a question for you about your free IRS file. If you want your refund, if you're getting a refund and you want it transferred to your bank account, do they charge you for that?
I don't think so. I think you can have it allotted directly. And maybe Mark can correct me if because he actually files returns. I don't file any returns anymore. But you can actually buy savings bonds.
What do you mean you don't file your returns anymore?
For other people. Oh. I'm sorry. I don't file. I mean,
speaking
sorry.
Of my sleeve.
It's been 25 years since I've filed a
return
since
for,
I
someone else.
For someone else. I used to work public accounting for a short amount of time. I only file one return a year for my wife and I and my kids.
Okay.
Yeah, so you have lots of options when you get into direct deposit. Basically, the rules are, under normal circumstances, you can split your deposit into three accounts maximum. So you could put some into savings, some into checking. You can direct money into an IRA. You can buy savings bonds. There's no fees for this, unless you're using some type of a bank product. And these would be like advances on your refund, or there's some other products that allow the tax preparer to get paid directly from your refund, but those are usually about a $35 fee. Outside of that, there's no charge. We encourage everybody to use direct deposit. Money goes from point A to point B. Your check's not lost in the mail. You're not calling me wondering where it is. And on the IP pins, you're assigned a number. We have lots of people that have IP pins. So your identity pin is updated every year. So in beginning of January, you're going to receive a letter from the IRS that has your new pin. That pin only works for 1 year. So if you have one, don't lose that piece of paper. If you do, you're sitting in my office and you're calling the IRS and you're going to get asked about 10,000 questions to prove your identity before they'll release that PIN number to you. And if we try to file your return without the PIN on it, it just gets rejected and your tax return doesn't get accepted. And then you either call to get that PIN or you have to mail your tax return in. We're going to discourage you from
using the mail at all. So this is good news, bad news. Yeah, keep your pen handy.
Keep your pen handy. It's just one of those things. When you get to January, everybody should set a folder up somewhere in their house where they collect all that stuff that shows up that says important tax document, and keep W-2s and 1099s in your IP pin and anything else that shows up, and just keep it all in one place.
I've been getting emails with my 1099 miscellaneous, and they're not secured emails, and it's beginning to upset me.
If you're receiving them through email, it should have your social redacted. We send out lots of 1099s electronically, but the software that we use, it redacts your social security number.
I have to look at it.
So
I don't think it's redacted.
That brings up another huge problem that we've seen in the last couple of years, and that is the electronic delivery of all of these tax documents and people showing up for appointments and they don't have everything they need because it didn't come to them on paper. So if you're receiving things electronically, make sure that you do something with that. Print that off. Save it somewhere you're going to remember, especially when we get into things like brokerage accounts. And people forget, like, oh, yeah, I got that other brokerage account, and there's a bunch of dividends and interest or sales of stocks that you forgot about. And then you show up for your appointment, and you don't have that document because it was delivered electronically. We file your tax return, and guess what you're going to receive? An IRS letter.
And you don't want to round file it. I want to know, there's a scam letter going out, apparently, notice of intent to levy Social Security benefits.
Yeah, so this was something that I found out from our special agent in charge. You know, most of these scams that I see have been email or phone scams, but this was actually a paper letter, a real letter, sent to somebody up in Maricopa County, and it said notice of intent to levy Social Security benefits, and it came from some random place called Benefits Suspensions Unit, Maricopa County, and it basically you know, because the scammers know that the public's being told not to fall for these scams. Phone scams. So yeah. They're like, they're actually sending stuff on paper. So when I say most scammers don't send letters, here's actually one that did. And it basically says this notice has been issued because there's going to be a lien, there's a tax liability has not been paid. So, you know, like I would know that this thing is, I'm holding it in front of me, which is obviously terrible for radio, but
hold it up and show us.
I'll show you. Yeah. But the whole point is, you know, it looks official enough where someone might fall for it. And, you know, here's the deal, you know, this is not from the Social Security Administration, so I would just put this in the round file. But I could see if 100 people got this letter, one person might fall for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so before, you know, I always ask people, you know, like, you know, show it to someone else. You know, if you're not sure, go talk to a friend or neighbor. Take it to your enrolled agent. Take it to, you
the
know,
IRS.
You know, to the IRS. Or take it, you know.
They're right downtown. You can walk in and say, hey, is this really you?
Right. Or, you know, Social Security office is on Campbell, I believe.
Right.
Over by that Sonic. You know, I drive by it all the time.
Yeah.
You know, so go in there. But unfortunately, you know, these criminals are always changing their tactics. There's always something new. Every year we always see some new scheme, whether it's phone, email or letter, text message, just be very careful. But we saw this and my special agent in charge wanted me to share. So you could look at it. So
the office is actually on First Avenue, I think, behind Sonic.
You're right, First Avenue. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
You're right.
We'll have people lining up over there on Campbell someplace.
Yeah, I'll drive into the wrong location.
They used to be on Campbell.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So you were almost there.
I was partially right.
I think the key with that stuff is, especially when you get a letter like that, it's targeting a demographic that is older, not going to be necessarily in front of the computer to see the news and the constant things that are popping up. And it's a demographic that's going to be more easily confused. And yeah, I mean, my advice would be the same. Like, have someone else look at it. Get your children involved. Have some other professional in your life take a look at it and do some other action before you call the number on there.
Yeah, that could be bad. Okay, what is this gig economy tax center?
Okay, so we're trying to get in the 21st century with the IRS, and we recognize that not everybody just works one job. A lot of people have a side hustle. And, you know, so whether you're driving rideshare like Uber or Lyft, okay, or you do Airbnb, or you fix things at people's house, that's tackle, or you're delivering food. So people, especially a lot of young people, have all these different things going on. Well, just that's taxable. Depending, you know, as long as you make over $400 net income, you need to report that income. And there's
$400 annually?
Net, yeah. So, but some people make, you know, thousands of dollars. You know.
I didn't know there was a base.
Yeah, so I mean, there's a small, $400 is just the threshold. But here's the deal. This whole gig economy tax center, and so gig, I had to look up what it meant. Like a side gig, that's where the gig comes from. I thought it was like some electronic term,
yeah,
like computer gigs.
No.
So it's like, you know, your side gigs. So we have a whole area in there because we want people to report that money. So it tells you how to report that money, but it also tells you how to keep records. And Mark will tell you, and he's always telling his clients, I'm sure, you know, keep good records. The reason why you want to keep records is because a lot of these deductions you can take on your tax return to reduce that income. Especially if you're an Uber driver, your biggest expense that you can deduct is your vehicle and all what's related to that. So we want people to report all their income, but we also want people to report their allowable deductions.
Now, you're talking Uber driver. The expense would be the maintenance of the car or the mileage of the car or both?
So I'm passing this one to Mark. That's okay. Why he's here.
One or the other.
One or the other.
So there's some rules on establishing one or the other, but what you'd have to look at is you need to have a mileage log. You should go out January 1st, take a picture of your mileage. December 31st, you're going to do that same thing, or the following January 1st. And then you keep a log of all the business miles in there. And at the end of the year, we can get a percentage from those numbers. What was your business use percentage and what was your personal use percentage? From there, you can either take the standard mileage against that number of miles, or you can deduct that percentage of your actual expenses. But it's one or the other. Once you start with the actual expenses, you have to keep actual expenses. Frankly, most time, taking the standard deduction results in a better long-term deduction for you. You can deduct 58 cents a mile for the next 10 years on your car. That's going to far exceed the cost of writing off the actual expenses.
Okay. All right. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a few. Thanks for staying with us. Our guests today are Mark Barnes, an enrolled agent and owner of Copper Canyon Tax Service, and IRS Special Agent Brian Watson. I'm curious about this bullet point here. What are ghost preparers?
So a ghost preparer is someone that prepares tax returns, does not use professional software, is not even typically licensed or registered to prepare tax returns, and then refuses to sign the tax return as they get that sent in. There's two different ways this can happen. First one is they are going to hand you your tax return back and say, here are your tax returns done, mail this in. And in the section where the prepare information would be, that is blank. Or they're going to e-file your tax return for you using an individual level software that's supposed to be used a maximum of, I believe, 3 times. And they just keep using it to prepare tax returns, and they all go in as self-prepared. Now, the problem is, legally, if you're accepting compensation, you're supposed to have a prepare tax ID number. You're supposed to be reporting this income as taxable, and you're supposed to have your information, your P10, and sign the tax returns that you have prepared for compensation. The other side of that is, when that return goes in and there's something drastically wrong with it, and then you call my office, our options become very limited on what we can do because nobody's name is on that tax return. If you come in and another preparer has prepared your return and it's completely wrong, I can at least use the defense that you relied on a professional to prepare your tax return to get rid of some of the penalties. If it's a self-prepared return or it's marked as a self-prepared return, I've lost that ability.
So you really need to, if you're hiring somebody, be careful who you're hiring.
If you're paying someone to prepare your tax return, you should expect it to come back as a professionally prepared return. It should have their information. It should be signed. Every return that leaves my office has my signature on it, a real from a pen signature.
So you're not out in front of your office in a costume saying tax service here?
No, I'm in there actually doing work and signing tax returns and dealing with the IRS. No, I don't have time to stand out front and wave signs or any of that stuff.
So this was on your bullet point. Brian, what does ghost preparer mean for the IRS?
Well, and Mark is saying everything that's right off of our IRS press release. And
okay.
I mean, ghost is a great way to call it because we don't know who's preparing these returns. And part of the thing too is we find, you know, if you're a good preparer, you're going to put your name on it. You know, just like if you're a builder of a building, you're going to put your name on that building somewhere, or people, you know, you're proud of your work.
Right.
These people don't want anything coming back to them. And we investigate every year return preparers across Arizona, all across the country. And we investigate these ghost preparers, and we actually have to do search warrants sometimes because we don't even know the extent of how many returns they file because we can't search them by their P10, their prepare tax identification number. The only way we can find out how many returns, the extent of their fraud, is to actually execute a search warrant on the business of the preparer, and then we'll actually either get paper returns or a lot of times most of it's on the computer. But we cannot track them if they don't do that. So a good preparer will put their name at the bottom, and they'll also go over it with you line by line, explain everything on there.
Wow. Okay. We have a caller on the line. Ingrid, what's on your mind?
My question may already been covered when I was digging to the cleaner. the proof of having paid somebody else to do the work would be in the receipt, right? Doesn't a customer get a receipt for having made payment to the preparer?
Oh, can they deduct their payment from the tax return?
Well, that, and also identify the person who prepared the tax return in the first place.
Oh, so okay. So I see your question. So yeah. Normally what happens with the ghost preparer is it's all cash-based business. So this is going to be a person that approaches you and says, hey, you know, for $50 or for $75 in cash, I'll prepare your tax return for you. So they don't accept checks. They don't accept any other form of payment that's going to be traceable. So you're not going to get a receipt from them. You're not going to have written a check to them with their name on it. This will just strictly be a cash transaction. And then they don't report the income. And then all the responsibility is falling back on you as the tax preparer or the taxpayer.
Did that answer your question, Ingrid? She hung up. Okay. Well, I hope that answered your question. Okay. What other schemes are going on now that people need to be aware of?
Just the ones that I'm tired of talking about, but
I'm sorry.
To talk about it. No, it's a frustration level from my end. It is the IRS impersonation scam continues to go on. IRS is going to send you a letter if we need to get a hold of you. We're never going to demand immediate payment over the phone. And then the one that we started seeing last summer is calls from the Social Security Administration. It's not the Social Security Administration that's calling. They're realizing the IRS phone scam is kind of not working as well anymore. So they've switched to Social Security, which is even scarier. Yeah. Because now it's not about your taxes. Now it's about your income. And a lot of people are on a fixed income, and Social Security is the biggest portion of it. And they say there's fraud in your account, and we're going to shut down your account because of this potential fraud. But then they're asking for money to open it up. So that's a huge red flag. The point is Social Security Administration will not call and threaten you to, you know, that your account's going to be, your income's going to be stopped. Hang up on these people. Tell your family and friends. That's the only way these crimes are going to be stopped is by drying up the pool of potential victims.
When there's a pause, I answer the phone and there's a pause. I'm saying hello and nobody answers. I hang up. I don't know who it was. Could be my mother. I don't know. I hang up. Because typically it probably wouldn't be.
And I get those calls all the time. I've been called at least 10 or 15 times to be notified that my Social Security account's on hold. Which is amazing because I'm not even old enough to collect yet, so my future account is on hold.
But by doing Social Security, they're really narrowing it down to some really vulnerable people,
right?
Taking advantage of elders,
right? And we have a new scam that we're investigating out of my office in Tucson, along with U.S. Postal, and it's sweepstakes, and the calls are coming out of Jamaica. And they're very organized criminal rings, and they're getting a hold of lists of people. And the lead list that they're calling, they want people that are over 80. And they call up and they say, you've won the publisher's clearinghouse sweepstakes.
Or the Irish sweepstakes.
They have all these different names, and they get you all excited. And then they say, okay, all we have to do now is just pay the tax on it or do a processing fee. And then they get you to pay, and then they get you to pay some more, and you've never won. And we've actually gotten some prosecutions in Arizona on it, and more to follow. But the problem is it's whack-a-mole. You put someone in jail, some other criminal is going to take that lead list and start calling people. So warn your family and friends. It might be one of those things where you have to have that sit down with mom and dad and say, look, these scams are out there. Don't fall for them because I don't want you to lose your hard-earned money.
Exactly. You need to protect your family. What about inflated returns?
What about inflated returns? Man, where to start with this one? At the end of the day, it all comes back to you have signed your tax return under the penalty of perjury, that it's true and correct, and you're responsible for that. So whether you're using a ghost preparer to prepare that return or some guy that, you know, your cousin's barber's friend that said that they can get you a bigger refund, you should have an understanding of what it is that they did to generate a bigger refund. Not all tax preparers are created the same. And there's a lot of things that we can do with some planning to save people additional money. That usually doesn't happen on a simple return, W-2 only, where one guy says, hey, your refund's $1,000, and somebody else says, we're going to get you $4,000 back. There's something happening to get that additional three, and you should understand, because it's going to come back to you at the end of the day. Coming back to our ghost preparer, we had a lady in our office who used her neighbor to prepare her return, self-prepared. And about 8 months later, she got the lovely letter from the IRS that she owed $19,000 in taxes.
Ooh.
Because the ghost preparer couldn't tell the lady, hey, you owe. So she kept changing the numbers until she had a small refund. And then during the interview process, it came out like, hey, I thought that was weird. I figured that I was going to owe, but she said I was getting a refund and it just seemed weird. And now she owes, and she owes a lot. And there's penalties and there's interest and there's additional penalties because the balance is over $5,000. And so in the long run, it cost her probably an extra $8,000 by the time she pays the penalties and interest by using her neighbor to prepare this return. So
don't you have to ask people what qualifies you to do somebody else's taxes?
They
should.
Or
even your own for that matter, but what qualifications do you have? Just because you're a good neighbor.
So I would say that if you were going in, if you just found out that you had cancer and you were going in for cancer treatment or brain surgery or anything that's very important to you, are you going to check the person out that's taking care of your health?
No, yeah. You don't want anybody filleting you.
You know, is this the situation where, hey, my cousin's barber's friend says that, you know, he can cure cancer and he's going to do it for $50 a treatment? Or are you going to go seek out a real professional that can potentially save your life? And we get into taxes, and a lot of people are looking at refunds. A lot of people think that there's some magic and they're being dealt these promises that don't exist in real life. And then these are the people that are in my office. These are the people that Brian are dealing with that have issues. You owe a lot of money. Sometimes you've ignored it. Sometimes your house, your cars are being seized, your bank accounts are being levied. And it all starts with they didn't qualify the person that was getting their personal confidential information to make sure that they were actually qualified to prepare this tax return to begin with.
Very important. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a few. Thanks for staying with us. Our guests are Mark Barnes, enrolled agent and owner of Copper Canyon Tax Service, and IRS Special Agent Brian Watson. I want to hear about some of these cases you've been working on.
Well, I haven't been working on, but some of my colleagues. So as a public information officer for the IRS, my job is to publicize these cases so that the public knows, and it's a huge deterrent effect, and it multiplies our efforts. I mean, we work a lot of criminal tax cases, but we also work embezzlement cases. Like, here's someone's being sentenced next week on the 3rd, a Scottsdale resident, a 27-year-old named Thomas Hancock. He embezzled $1.3 million from the company he worked for. And he created a whole scheme where he was creating false invoices and then a fake email. And then he was moving the money around and, you know, approving invoices. And it sounded like the company had terrible internal controls. But he's looking at a significant prison sentence at 27 years old for just being greedy. And, you know, he already had a high-paying job. So, like, we work a lot of embezzlement cases. We work a lot of drug cases. We have a drug case up in Phoenix, Juan Labrada Zazueta, being sentenced on Monday. The government is asking for 11 years in prison.
Whoa.
And I've actually seen drug cases where they get 20 years. His co-defendant, Marco Jara Lara, is being sentenced in March. Now, he was, Mr. Labrada Zazueta was the, basically had a supervisory role in a relatively small drug trafficking organization that distributed meth and cocaine. And what I found interesting about this case is the government files these sentencing memorandums to present to the judge. And then is interesting. It says, for many years during the last decade, the defendant has engaged in a business of peddling poison that is eating away at our society. So, and that's why that sentence is, even for a small case, 11 years. I mean, this guy is peddling poison. He's peddling this meth.
He's killing people.
Know. Right. Now, obviously, it's a free country. People have a choice to take an illegal drug. You know, it's not a gun to their head, but he's making it a whole lot easier, you know. But we see this a lot. I mean, there are, it's just nonstop.
Okay, what if somebody that bought his meth did die? Could he be charged with homicide?
I don't know. Probably.
I would think so.
I mean, we don't, those aren't the cases we do. That's usually on the state side. It's tough. We're working a lot of opioid cases, you know, all across the country, we're investigating these pill mills where these doctors are basically like 90% of their clients are on opioids, and their whole office is, that's how they prescribed everybody. Everyone comes in, everyone gets pills. So we work a lot of those cases. And then what's been shocking to me too, just looking at our recent caseload, is the number of women that are getting wrapped up in these drug conspiracies. Now, we've had some where the woman is the head of the organization, but for the vast majority of these drug organizations, it's definitely male-dominated. But we have a lady, Magdalena Hernandez. She traveled from last fall, or actually November of 2018, traveled from Arizona to Minnesota to pick up drug proceeds from an unknown male. She went and deposited it into her bank account for the same bank, but she deposited the money in Minnesota. And this is what she did. This is what we see the drug dealers do. They break up the deposit. She did 6 deposits, and it totaled $9,960.
Keep it under the $10,000.
They're trying to keep it under $10,000, but unfortunately, that triggers a report for us, a suspicious activity report. And she basically admitted that she used her bank account to handle drug proceeds. Now, I don't know what she's going to get for her sentence. She might get probation. She might get prison. But it's a good, we tell people about this, and we'll be putting out a press release later about this when she's sentenced. You know, it's just not worth it. You do these actions with your money for these drug organizations, you're going to end up in prison, and you're at least going to have a felony.
And you know what? I've had John Lovett from Counter Narcotics on the show, and the people who are driving and you know, the footman, they're low man on the totem pole. They don't get paid that much to be doing what they're doing, and then they end up in prison forever.
Right. And we try to get the heads of these organizations, but a lot of times they're very well insulated by using the lower level mopes, as we call them, to handle their dirty work.
Yeah, that sounds like that's what happened with her. Well, you have to be smarter than that.
Just, you know, you sleep a whole lot better at night when you're not committing crimes or you're not cheating on your taxes. That's what I found. You may not be driving the brand new car, you know, and you may not be going on the fanciest vacation, but, you know, there's something to be said about living a simple life and keeping your nose
clean.
An
honest life.
Yes.
Yeah.
Less stress.
Okay, Mark, tell us, you just named a form before we came back on air. I don't know anything about this form. What is it?
Okay, so this year, brand new, thank you, Congress, we have the 1040-SR, and this is actually a form that was legislated, that was found to be necessary, and this is the 1040 senior return. So if you take a look at the standard 1040 and you compare that with the 1040-SR, the first thing you'll notice is that the font is substantially larger.
Okay.
So when your eyes are old and tired, this makes it easier to read. And in addition to that, so if you haven't looked at the new form, 2 years ago, a 1040 was a full page. And last year, thanks to lots of marketing from Washington, it was a half a page, and it was called the postcard. And this year, because the postcard was not very effective, we're now up to 3/4 of a page. So on a standard 1040, the bottom quarter of the page is blank. And on the bottom quarter of this new senior return, it has the chart that has the standard deduction amounts. So if you are filing that return and you're filing that by hand using the actual paper form, you can see right at the bottom without looking in the 1040 instructions to see what your standard deduction is. And it has the standard amounts plus the over 65 additions to your standard deduction.
Do you get extra money if you're over 65?
You get extra money if you're over, well, you get extra deduction. If you're over 65.
Like what? You don't have kids.
It's if you're over 65, I believe if one of you is over 65, you're get an additional $1,350. And if both of you are over 65, I believe it's $1,650. And that's added to your standard deduction of either $12,200 or $24,400 if you're taking the standard deduction.
Did not know that.
So it's a little extra perk for our seniors.
That's why we keep you around.
But yeah, I mean, the real difference is the font's larger on the form, so that it's a little easier to read.
That's, I'm glad they thought of that.
Yeah.
I'm sitting here with brand new glasses and I can't see anything.
Yeah, all the problems that we have as a world and as a country, and Congress came up with a form with larger font on it.
That's why they get paid the big bucks. Okay, give me an idea. How much money is actually lost?
In what?
In these schemes where people aren't paying their taxes and everything. Do they have any type of a database that says, okay, they should have paid this, but...
Well, so there is something called the tax gap, which is the amount of money that is paid to the IRS and what actually should be collected by the IRS. And I don't have those figures in front of me, but if someone was interested in that, you could just... do a search engine, IRS, you know, tax gap, 2019, 2018, because, and our tax gap is not as bad as it is in some other countries, because, but the tax gap is all the illegal, I mean, the unreported income. So people who don't report tips, or people who have a trade, do bartering with people, or people that, you know, underreport their income. So we, our goal with the IRS is to make that tax gap get smaller and smaller. But there will always be people who are willing to cheat. But then if you're asking about schemes, like, you know, the IRS phone scam, the impersonation scam, we have a documented $70 million that's been lost in that scheme.
Oh, my God.
But we know that number is much higher because people either don't know they've been ripped off, they figure what's the point, or they're just too embarrassed to report it.
Yeah, that's pretty sad.
Yeah, each year, TIGDA, which is the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration, they issue lots of reports, and one of those reports does come back to what the tax gap is. Not exactly sure, but it would be very simple to search up.
If you're really wanting to know, you can go look it up on the computer. Google it.
Google it. It's in the billions of dollars. It's not in the trillions, so it wouldn't cover the deficit that we have, but certainly I believe it's in the hundreds of billions of dollars every year that's lost in tax revenue. And ultimately, at the end of the day, somebody else has to pay that. Like, that's the reality, is somebody else has to pay because someone else is cheating. It's no different than if you're at the grocery store, people are shoplifting, somebody else has to pay a higher cost to make up for what's lost.
Right.
Okay. Tips. How many tips? How much can you make in tips before you have to report it?
Tips are reportable income. So the answer is a dollar.
Okay.
There's some other requirements on a certain level of tips and how they need to be reported. But the reality is, if you were working for tips, you're receiving some form of compensation on a W-2 and tips. Those tips should be reported to either your employer and represented in box 7 of your W-2, or they need to be reported on your tax return.
So you have to keep track of your tips.
You need to keep track of them. In the United States, all income is subject to taxation, unless it's specifically excluded from taxation. And tips are not on the list of what's excluded.
Okay. So we don't have, like, you know, a little area where we can make money and not report it.
Unfortunately, no.
No, I'm just checking. I keep asking, hoping one of these days you'll say, yeah, you don't have to report that. But it's not working. So, okay, we've got like a minute. What words of wisdom do you want to leave with our listeners?
I just encourage people. I always end with going to irs.gov. It's everything. It's a one-stop shop. If you have questions that you can just do on your own, you can do your own research. If you have questions, if you have a paid preparer like Mark, who's an enrolled agent, you ask them questions. Also, irs.gov, like I mentioned earlier, you can file your tax return. You can look at our new Gig Economy Tax Center. You can get any form you need. And there's also videos. It's actually very, very helpful. So we always encourage people to start there.
educate yourself and tell us quickly, tell us the difference between an enrolled agent and a CPA.
I don't know if this is a quick conversation. Basically, CPA is, certified public accountant. This is typically someone that went to school for accounting and has passed exams at the state level. An enrolled agent doesn't have to have a specific education requirement, but they have taken tests with the Department of the Treasury. Both are required to have regular licensing and education requirements.
And you have to keep it up.
You have to keep it up.
Okay. I want to thank everybody for listening today. Thank both of you for coming in and educating us. I always learn something new when you're here. And until next week, shop local, stay safe.